Hey guys, I'm still away at the moment, so no new episode today, unfortunately. But instead, I thought I'd share an episode from another show that I really enjoy. Jonathan Williams is the charismatic host of the Welsh History Podcast. If you've been listening to this show for a while, you've probably heard our episode on Owain Glyndŵr way back in Season 2. Glyndŵr is one of many fascinating figures from the history of Wales, a region that I think is very underrated. The Welsh History Podcast traces the history of the Welsh people from ancient times to modern day, but the episode I plucked out is episode 85, The Rise of Llywelyn the Great. Llywelyn is a titanic figure in Welsh history who was equally responsible both for the kingdom's high watermark and its later subjugation to the English. This guy was a big deal. I mean, he was one of the barons who forced wily English King John to sign the Magna Carta, an event that's often seen as the first stepping stone to our modern democracy. So have a listen, and if you enjoy the episode, check out the Welsh History Podcast on wherever you're listening right now. Great to speak with you again. We'll be back soon with new episodes. Take it away, Jonathan.
Welcome back to the Welsh History Podcast, episode 85, The Rise of Llywelyn the Great. As we've covered this podcast, I think one of the things that I've heard mentioned to me quite a bit is the idea of talking about an era in Welsh history, which I think a lot of people have a lot of ideas about and a lot of knowledge of. Certainly, if you have studied any sort of Welsh history at all, you know about the two characters we're going to get to over the next few episodes. One of which, of course, is Llywelyn the Great, the Prince of Wales, and his grandson, Llywelyn the Last. These two gentlemen kind of make that connection that we will certainly be covering in depth quite a bit. They are important figures in both the rise of Gwynedd as the supreme power in Wales, and also the reason why they collapse and Wales is officially conquered. You can't, even if you look at it from a standpoint of a positive Welsh source, you can't do anything but recognize that that is the case, that both of these gentlemen are the reason why it rose and the reason why it fell. And because of that, they're fascinating people to look into. They have fascinating lives that go along with it. We have a lot of writings about them simply because they were in an era where England was suddenly receiving a lot more documentation because of Edward I and his, you know, progenitors and his ancestors as the Plantagenets kind of took over ruling England. They obviously started to conflict with their Western neighbors and Northern neighbors, let's be honest, and neighbors in general. And so this is, as I say, a very interesting and fascinating era to look at. So how about we get to it, shall we? In 1160, Madog ap Merdith died and Powys split into a north and south version to the various heirs. In northern Powys, the heirs were able to control things for a while. Until 1236, it remained a kingdom with some remaining influence. However, in south Powys, things were stable, but with the death of Owain Cynfelwg, after 1197, the kingdom became more of a bit player in Welsh and English politics. It would remain an existing kingdom for most of the 13th century, at least a name on the map, rather than that fundamental player it had played for the previous 100 years. And because of that, it still maintained some relevancy nonetheless, but we have to keep in mind that it stopped being a significant power in the power playing of kings and princes across both England and Wales. And of course, came to an end at the same time that independence did. In the same year that Owen died, Lord Rhys, the Prince of South Wales, passed away. His death sent his dynasty into chaos. He'd had 15 sons, 7 of which were bastards, 8 of which were legitimate, according to the Welsh. In this prestigious family, that meant that there were a lot of people to argue about who owns and should have what. While the oldest son, Griffith ap Rhys, kept things relatively together, but only for 4 years, as he passed away in 1201, which meant his influence on Welsh history was mild, to say the least. And because of this, his kingdom would fall into chaos and ruin, and realistically would again be another major dynasty that would come to an abrupt end very shortly. As these centers of former Welsh dominance dissipated, in their place, of course, Gwynedd started to rise again. We talked a little bit about this in the past. The largest benefactor of Powys was Owain Gwynedd, who lived 9 years past his brother-in-law. Owain died in December of 1169, to the everlasting praise of his chroniclers, who described him as a man of great goodness, with very great nobility, wisdom, and the bulwark of Wales. His progeny did not fare as well, at least for the next 30 years. Unfortunately for them, Gwynedd, in this period, had a lot of instability. Hywel, who was the heir to the throne, wasn't able to outlast his brothers, and was eventually ousted by Dafydd, his brother, who sent all of his brothers and nephews packing, and a lot of whom ended up in Ireland, one of whom did not. We'll talk a little bit about him in a few minutes. However, during all of this, there was one brother who ceased, or at least was not really ever mentioned, and that's Iaiwerth ap Owain. Now, apologies if my pronunciation is not great, but here we go. Now, he was someone who was claimed to be a son of Owain, someone who had been considered lesser important, lesser in his abilities. In fact, he was nicknamed the Flat Nose. At least this was mentioned by Gerald, who was close enough to being a peer of him. And this may be due to a couple of different things. According to later tradition, he may have been disfigured, thus the name Flat Nose, which would explain that, or possibly also disabled. This may explain why he plays no part in the conflicts of his brothers. If he had a mental instability or a mental disability, he may not have been able to take part in it. He may not have understood fully what was going on. If it was just a disfigurement, then that doesn't explain that, but it could be that he didn't have the followers surrounding him that, say, someone who was considered to be more noble or more delicate in appearance, let's say, would have. So he may have struggled to get a following behind him. Also, there is just not a whole lot about him that gets mentioned, so you also wonder how significant he is in this conflict with his brothers. Now, Gerald of Wales was not very impressed with what happened in this period. He says, "I shall pass over with silence what was done by Owen's son in our day. When he himself was dying, in their desperate attempts to gain the inheritance, they showed complete disregard for brotherly ties." Gerald goes so far as to claim that only one of the sons was even legitimate. But this may be due to Owen's excommunication over marrying his first cousin, Kristen. However, the sons that he called legitimate was Iaiwerth. Iaiwerth was married to Merad, or also known in some sources as Margaret, the daughter of Madog, and seemingly ruled a small portion of South Gwynedd while his brothers fought over the main crown. In 1173, in a year that the Brute describes as the best in the spring and a misery the rest of the year, Merad bore a son to Iaiwerth, and they named him Llewellyn. A year later, the baby and mother were widowed and fatherless, as Iaiwerth died in 1174. Of course, other than these bits and pieces which we have, that's it. That's all we really know about one of the fathers of the greatest princes in Wales. Someone who had such a historical influence on the rest of Welsh history. And his parental figure is just not really important enough to be named beyond that, which, if he was disabled in some way, may explain a lot. He would possibly be considered an embarrassment compared to the backdrop of his father and his son. And with that in mind, the chroniclers may have wanted to avoid talking about him other than just in the aspect of him being a parent. His son, on the other hand, appears to have grown up with a chip on his shoulder. According to Gerald, When he went north to visit Gwynedd, he found Llywelyn at 12 years old, already looking to bring down his uncles, Dafydd and Rhodri. As Gerald put it, the uncles had lands and connections, and Llywelyn was completely destitute of lands or money, but he was legitimate and could therefore trust in the vengeance of God. So why was Llywelyn so driven? Likely, his father lost his possessions either at his death or shortly before when the overthrow happened of all of the brothers and nephews. He was most likely kept out of Gwynedd for a while. Much like his great-grandfather, he was left wanting more than what life had allotted him at that point. His mother, it was suggested, may have remarried to a Corbett, who was a marcher from the Shropshire area, which, as a princess to a Powys monarch, might make some sense, as obviously Shropshire and Powys are side by side, and it would mean that Llywelyn was brought up outside of Wales, or at the very least, outside of Gwynedd, and this in itself may have stroked the fire of his desire for vengeance. Looking at the math, though, I think Gerald may have had his timing off. Most likely, if this was during the Baldwin mission of 1188 and he met Llywelyn then, he was likely closer to 15 than 12, which would make a lot of sense, as he would have been seen of age, which at least now would be a threat to his uncles. At 12 years old, they may have considered that an adult, but the reality of it is, a preteen leading an army successfully, I'm not sure that would have worked as well. However, going back to his upbringing, Llywelyn was well-versed in French and the courtly language of England at the time. He worked well with the marcher lords as well, which makes you wonder if his connections in early life served him in later life, as he had to deal with all these English lords who would be clamoring to take him down a peg under normal circumstances. Whether he was 12 or 15, Llywelyn did make his way to Wales. If we were to go by the timeline, that puts him in the area during about 1189. The Brute, or the Chronicle of the Princes, tells us that he was working with his uncle to take down Dafydd, and certainly worked with his cousins, if nothing else. The three brothers, or at least their sons, had ruled Gwynedd together for some time. So what had set them at each other at this point, this of course being the questions, why were the uncles fighting amongst themselves, and why did they see a need to take down Dafydd? Dafydd had ruled Gwynedd for 20 years by this time. His brothers and nephews finally had carried out their attack against him. Kynan and Rhodri were a party to the defeat of their brother, which is an interesting in light of the comments by Gerald about the brothers, and specifically about this idea that Llywelyn somehow didn't need them. Apparently he kind of did. And Llywelyn and his cousins, Merduth and Griffith, sons of Kynan, and they were effectively the three leaders in charge of overcoming Dafydd. Now, the one question you have is this because the younger generation was sick of the older generation? Was Llywelyn kind of the ringleader who got these two involved, or was it the other way around? Were they already trying to revolt and went to Llywelyn seeking his help because of his connections to the East, both with the English court and with the Powys court? Could there be, you know, multiple reasons why he's brought on board, and did he just basically assume charge once he got there? Or, like I said, was he always the one who was in charge and these guys just came to him needing his help? Or did he come to them needing their help? We don't fully know. Unfortunately, the stories and the explanations we have don't go into it. But certainly, it does make one wonder if that is exactly what happened. And as it turns out, at a battle at Aberconwy in 1194, they defeated Dafydd and captured him. And he was then sent away from Gwynedd eventually to live out the rest of his days in England, while Llywelyn traded places with his uncle as the ruler of the southern part of Gwynedd and the most powerful ruler in the triumvirate, if you want to call it that, between the uncles and their nephew. In 1195, Rhodri passed away, leaving his lands into the hands of his sons, but they would not last in their hands that long. In 1197, as mentioned earlier, Powys and Doithbarth suffered losses that left them unable to stop Llywelyn, who had conquered much of eastern Gwynedd at the time. He jointly ruled with his cousins, those two that had worked with him earlier through the revolt, and were very much a part and a party to this, but by 1201, Griffith had also died, and thus, slowly but surely, Llywelyn was taking control. And it seemed this marked an important point for Llywelyn, because at this point, with Griffith dead and one of the two brothers and sons of Cynan dead, it made it easier for Llywelyn to start to move in and take territory. He started to, for lack of a better word, steal territory from his cousins, and started to move towards taking all of Gwynedd back for his control. And at the same time, he was making maneuvers by making alliances with kings and powys, and trying to build connections within the kinship. Because, of course, there is some speculation that Llywelyn may not have even known a lot of Welsh before he got back to Wales, that because he'd been speaking in courts in England and he had learned Latin and French, which were major languages, obviously, in England at this time, he may not have been as well versed at it. That's purely academic speculation without a lot of backing at this point. But certainly it is one that you have to question with the way his life went, is if he had a lot of opportunities to continue to learn and develop his links to his cousins and ancestors and all of these people that were spread across Wales that he had some sort of relationship with. Keep in mind that these people are still descendants of Mervyn and of Rhodri the Great. So there's still all of those ancestral links in with each other. This is a time when everybody was known by patronymics. And so, you know, the farther back you could go, the better your linkage is with the past, the better it would be for you. So if you can say, you know, I'm a descendant of Rhodri the Great, that certainly helps. And of course, that family linkage, whether it's real or imagined, as the case may be, it sometimes certainly helps when you're dealing with relatives, in quotes. Of course, the one person we haven't really mentioned a lot of in this is the King of England. At this point, in 1201, the king is John, of course, of Robin Hood fame, for those of you that know those stories. And of course, more importantly, in history, he's also known for the Magna Carta because of his mismanagement of his lords. And Llywelyn has a lot to relate to John because, of course, there's a lot of things that come about that he has to deal with the person who would eventually become his father-in-law. And luckily, we have a copy of some of the documents that they drew up together in 1201. Of course, they entered into a treaty, and this treaty, which the text of which still survives, says that Llywelyn and his leading men, or his nobles, swore loyalty, fealty, and promised homage to the king, while John then conceded that either Welsh or English law might be employed in the lands subject to Llywelyn, thus giving him royal recognition and, of course, surviving practices of Welsh legal framework being recognized by the English king would obviously be important. I mean, it does make sense. Although, in all fairness, there isn't much the English could have done if he legitimately practiced English or Welsh law. I don't think they could have enforced a whole lot. But the fact that this is put down in some sort of law or some sort of code or treaty shows that it was important to both sides and did mean something. And in fact, historian R.R. Davies argues that this link between the laws of Wales and the laws of England are one of the conflicts and one of the key marker points of the 13th century. It was one of the big debates between the two sides as to what everybody had to be respected towards and respectful for. And I think that's important to keep in mind. Not dissimilarly important was 4 years later, a relationship between Llywelyn and John had grown so much that they actually formed a familial relationship because John's illegitimate daughter Joanna married Llywelyn. And this, of course, is a major significance because this would be one of the first times that the Anglo nobility married into a Welsh nobility as opposed to the other way around. Of course, we have the example of Nest, who was the lover of the King of England, Henry I, and then eventually became a part of the Marcher Lords as she married one of them. But the reality of it is we didn't have a lot of instances where that was the other way around. Not since the Normans had come anyway. And this is kind of one of those first things which creates yet another link between the two sides. Of course, this doesn't stop either side from fighting. It never did with the Welsh. Why would it now? So certainly that's something to keep in mind. But nonetheless, it's an important point in the history of the Welsh-English relationship. And most importantly, it also acknowledges the fact that Llywelyn, even at this stage, and we're talking about someone who's in his 20s at this point, had a dominant over his kingdom, but also had dominance enough to be recognized as important enough that the King of England would marry his daughter to him. And so he had to be somebody he had to worry about. He had to have treaties with. He had to be someone of significance enough that you had to work with and marry into to keep him on your side. Because if you didn't, who knows what would happen. Now, we know at this point, shortly thereafter, John will get into all sorts of trouble with his own nobles. And within a decade, will have signed the Magna Carta. And of course, Llywelyn and his heirs will have something to do with that as well. But nonetheless, this is an important point for the King of England. It's an important point for the Prince of Wales. And it will, again, show the significance of the role that Llywelyn was playing in the Welsh politics and really in the English politics. So it's something to keep in mind. It's a significant moment. And because of that, it's the moment that we're going to close out our discussion of this point in his life. As we progress along, we'll talk about a lot of other things in relation to that, to Llywelyn and his life, and we'll get in more details of his growing kingdom and how he ruled it. But until next time, we'll talk to you all later. Thank you so much for listening. For those of you who are Patreon supporters, please check out the Patreon page. We just put up a new video yesterday, and of course, there is more to come on this front. And if you want to become a supporter, certainly you can do that at patreon.com/Welsh History. And I put up some commentary videos periodically, and I'm trying to do those on a monthly basis going forward, and talk about kind of what you want to see coming forward out of this podcast. So please consider checking it out. And I appreciate all those who have. And I appreciate your listening, and thank you, everyone. If you have any comments, questions, or concerns, you can always reach me at welshhistorypodcast@gmail.com, on Twitter at welshhistorypod, or on Facebook at facebook.com/welshhistorypodcast. Until next time, everyone, take care, have a great day, enjoy your weeks, and we'll see you later. Bye!
This has been a Distractions Media production, and for everything we do, check out distractionsmedia.com.
Hello, this is Gary Chahot welcoming you to check out the French History Podcast. Our main show covers the history of France from the first humans until present. If you liked Mike Duncan's The History of Rome and wanted a similar program covering the land of beauty, culture, and love, we are exactly that. We also host world-renowned scholars who have delivered guest episodes on their specialties, including 18th century pirates, revolutionary booksellers in 20th century Paris, the special friendship between the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, and numerous others. Learn what you love and listen to the French History Podcast today.
A news story gets shared by a friend on social media, or you catch a tweet that really makes your blood boil. But how do you separate fact from fiction? That's the premise behind Disinformation, a 10-part series from Evergreen Podcasts and Emergent Risk International coming this fall. Tune into Disinformation wherever you get your podcasts, and remember, don't believe everything you read.